Good morning, Prince George. This is Uncle Don with the 21st edition of Uncle Don Reads the Comics on CFUR 88.7 FM. This is your campus-based community radio. If you like it, get involved. If you don't like it, get involved. Today's the 13th of November, 2002. Don't forget to wind your calendars. Big book sale tomorrow. You may have seen the book sales in the university's agora from time to time over the last couple of years. These sales are to dispose of books from the university library that are surplus to their needs. Some are out-of-date reference books, some are donations that are deemed unsuitable for the collection, and some are extra copies of books that have been held in storage. The administration of the Weller Library have decided that it's better to allow the students, staff, and faculty of UNBC to buy these books for a nominal fee than to have them recycled. We hate to see these books go, but the Weller Library is cramped now and they need the space. Tomorrow, Thursday the 14th of November, the next sale will begin at 9 a.m. in the Agora. This sale will be a departure from previous sales, which had fixed prices for all books. This time, all sales will be by donation. You'll just pay what you think the book is worth. Now is a great time to flesh out your collection of books to make sure that the next time you move, you will curse us all. My weekly dedication. I'm dedicating this show to two of Prince George's outstanding citizens who are truly dedicated to public service without any thought to their personal welfare. These two individuals, our mayor, His Worship Colin Kinsley, and Councillor Shirley Gretton, had the bulk of their last election campaigns financed by John Major, owner of our local casino. Neither of these politicians allowed this generous financing to influence their decision to support the sale of valuable city land to Mr. Major. I have no doubt that this spirit of self-sacrifice will carry them on to a decision to rezone this land to allow the relocation of Mr. Major's shabby casino to a glitzy gambling joint on the land on Highway 16, thus helping to beautify our great city. Congratulations, O selfless leaders! The Yanks have had their election now. No longer can Americans claim to have been snookered by George Bush, Jr. or Sr. They've had 2 years to judge son of a Bush, and they have now affirmed support for his imperial ambitions. We can no longer give them the benefit of the doubt. They must be held to account for the crimes of their leaders. Ironically, while the Americans have reaffirmed their America uber alles foreign policy and the domestic attack on the freedoms that were supposed to be the basis for their revolution, the Iraqi people have had little say in their own government. While the Americans have shared guilt, the Iraqis have shared innocence. The Americans had a choice in last week's election. Now they affirm their government's intent to attack the citizenry of a country whose citizens do not share responsibility for the crimes of their leaders. Which is the rogue state? The coming war for oil. While the sponsors of the coming war prattle on about human rights in Iraq and weapons of mass destruction, the business press tells a different story. The Globe and Mail had a story headed, Oil Prices Will Plummet If the United States Attacks Iraq, wherein a columnist says that Canada's oil patch has been a huge beneficiary of the fear of war. Oil prices in the $30 a barrel range are driven by fear and uncertainty in the future, not by any shortage of oil. World demand for oil is actually steady with the global recession. Supply is stable. The author speculates that the price would be closer to $20 a barrel without a war scare. There is fear that the war will lead to a fall in supply, especially if Saudi Arabia decreases its massive oil flow in protest. But the Americans have room to force other suppliers to pick up the slack in the short run, and they are counting on taking over Iraqi oil supplies in the long term. Iraq has oil in the ground second only to Saudi Arabia. Under the current UN sanctions, Iraq produces about 2 million barrels a day. Already, multinational oil companies are discussing their role in the Iraqi oil industry after the war. An article in the Financial Times predicts that oil production can be increased to 7 or 8 million barrels a day within a few years. All it takes is foreign investment, which means American corporations taking over ownership of the Iraqi oil industry. That's a huge prize for Bush's friends in the oil industry in the States. Both of the above articles predict that the war will bring a decline in oil prices, not a rise. The predicted fall from $30 to the $20 range will be a big blow for the Canadian producers who have been riding high on the higher prices. Watch for a big blow to Alberta. This will increase their opposition to the modest targets of the Kyoto Accord. Interesting times coming. My prediction is that a decrease of $10 a barrel, which translates into roughly 10 cents a liter, will not be passed on to us in gasoline prices. Don't hold your breath for the 76-cent price drop to 66 cents. Never again. Therein lies a tale of supposed competition between oil companies in our oligopolistic economy. The Office of Homeland Security is prepared. According to Pat Buchanan, frequent contender for President of the United States and tub-thumping fundamentalist preacher, Canadians are soft on security. He says he doesn't care if Canadians don't like being humiliated, photographed, and fingerprinted at the American border. The lunatic gun-toting Americans need to be protected from Canadian terrorists bent upon visiting Disneyland or vacationing in Florida. But according to Mr. Buchanan, there's another dangerous Palestinian coming who might try to visit the United States. This man's been here before, and he was a troublemaker then. There's no reason to believe he would be less radical now. When he was here before, he was convicted of trying to overthrow another empire not unlike that of the current United States. He caused a major disturbance in a synagogue. He practiced medicine without a license. He also led a band of malcontents who intended to overthrow civil governments. If this man should arrive at the American border, they would really be ready for him. He could be expected to be photographed, interrogated, fingerprinted, and, based on his record, probably sent to Guantanamo, Cuba for torture and further interrogation. I can see it now as American Special Forces interrogators have this man strapped to the chair and the electrodes are applied. Who are the other 12 men that you conspired with? What are their last names? Are you a Christian? That answer might cause Jesus some real problems. The function of citizenship. For a democracy to function, a nation requires a pool of concerned citizens willing and able to participate in the political process. It also requires citizens who have the education and critical thinking skills to vote intelligently. If you'll accept these propositions, then it follows that developing citizens with the knowledge and ability to vote intelligently would be the most important function of our school system, and that the schools are among the most important institutions of our society. Our schools should also be training the future leaders that voters will elevate into political positions. The best and the brightest of our citizens should be the teachers of our children. Our schools have failed. We've not developed a system that gives a good enough foundation for our children. We've been starving the schools of operating funds and discouraging the best and brightest from becoming teachers. Before any child leaves school, they should have a decent grounding in history, mathematics, geography, English, critical thinking, and at least one foreign language. I recently read that the Japanese school system, every high school graduate has completed 1 year of calculus. Here in Prince George, I find young people in the stores who cannot change a dollar without a calculator. Our former Premier Van der Zandt railed publicly about having to face French on his cornflakes boxes. Meanwhile, many people around the world routinely speak several languages. Within the system, we should be encouraging the best students to achieve the highest levels possible. Instead of weeding students out of the post-secondary system through high tuition fees, we should be subsidizing them as some other societies do. If we let our talented students be squeezed out of higher education, we may end up with an elitist education system where only the rich can put their offspring through the system. We can see a product of that now in the United States. The Bush dynasty has bought its way into education, supposedly, and power. Unless you believe that George Bush Sr. was gifted with superlative genes, it is hard to believe that Georgie and Jeb represent the best and brightest in the United States. If they do, it's time to quarantine and fumigate that poor land. While encouraging the best to go on to university and postgraduate studies, we should not neglect the worst. Half of students will be below average, and in our system, half the voters, plus one, are enough to put a candidate in office for 4 or 5 years. Roughly half the population of our prisons is functionally illiterate. I can't draw conclusions as to cause and effect, but we can all agree that there is a correlation there. Why? More flagrant government discrimination. I want you to know that I have sought legal advice on a discrimination that I am facing from the Canadian federal government. Based solely on the date of my birth, a circumstance entirely beyond my control, I've been denied the legal status of a United Empire loyalist. If I had been born 2 centuries earlier, I could have joined the earlier exodus from the Republic that was illegitimately declared on our southern border. According to the Canadian Encyclopedia, in 1789, Lord Dorchester, Governor-in-Chief of British North America, proclaimed that the Loyalists and their children should be allowed to append UE to their names. The Loyalists were those who were born in the 13 colonies and left during the American Revolution or shortly thereafter. Some recognition was given to those who left later. They were considered late Loyalists. Since I came up here in 1975, and 1967, but that's another story. I suppose I am officially a late, late loyalist, but I object to the discrimination. I want to be officially a loyalist since I left for political reasons and I deny the legitimacy of the government of the so-called United States of America. I will pursue my right officially to append UE to my name, and I will use it unofficially until my rights are recognized. I realize that I am probably in violation of some obscure section of the Canadian Criminal Code by so doing, but I am prepared to stand upon my rights as a citizen of the Dominion of Canada and the Empire. I will suffer the slings and arrows of the law and suffer endurance vile, if necessary, to defend my rights that have been denied me solely based on the date of my birth. Like Martin Luther King, I have a dream. I am addressing this to the citizens of our southern neighbors. The rest of you may listen if you wish. If you don't care about Canada's relations with the states, please turn off your radio and head off to the nearest bingo hall or our illustrious casino. I trust that you, our neighbors to the south and west, will bear with me. As a Canadian and former American, I wish to invoke my right to speak on a subject close to your hearts. Your country was founded in revolution, brought on by the governance of a foreign empire and sparked by a declaration of independence. Your battle cry was relatively simple: no taxation without representation. The result of that bloody revolution was a new country that was self-governing, for better or worse. Canada has a gentler tradition. We've had no bloody revolution, nor even a civil war to celebrate. We have separated from the British Empire, in all but name, without resort to arms. I beg you to accept the proposition that we have the right to pursue the same peaceful path again. Your Declaration of Independence states, inter alia, that governments are instituted among men, sic, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, and that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government. Times have changed, but these rights and responsibilities of citizens are immortal. Over the past couple of decades, we Canadians have been under the rule of quisling governments who have led us into the role of colonial state again. The government, which we find offensive, is an international one, administered by agreements like NAFTA and not responsible to control by the people. We now wish to make our own Declaration of Independence to be followed with a peaceful divorce from the American Empire. Canada has a right to be a sovereign state, administering our own territory for the benefit of our own citizens. We do not wish to have our lands, resources, industries, or services run by foreigners for the benefit of foreigners. We want to take control of our own borders and to determine for ourselves what goods and individuals cross those borders. While you have an interest in preventing the interest from Canada of terrorists and drugs, we have a legitimate interest in preventing the importation of illegal guns, gangsters, and violent lunatics from your country. Our goals are different and not amenable to homogenization. You protect your side and we will protect ours. You have already recognized your control of persons and goods by tightening the common border. Now it is our turn. I am sure you will understand when we require all American residents to obtain a visa prior to entering our country. We will, of course, give special attention to native-born Americans due to their group propensity toward violence. We want to be able to limit the importation of goods made in your country by child or slave, that is, prisoner labor. We want to keep out goods made by corporations that violate international standards in dealing with other nations. We don't want goods made by polluting industries. If our industries have to adhere to standards of the Kyoto Accords, we do not want your industries that do not to have an unfair advantage. We intend to cancel the free trade agreement and the NAFTA. This is not unlike your recent cancellation of the ABM treaty. We will reassert our sovereign right to apply tariffs on goods without the intervention of undemocratic tribunals. We will apply these with the sole goal of protecting our own industries and economy. We understand that you have a reciprocal right, which you are already exercising by applying tariffs to our softwood lumber. Surely you will understand our position. And we claim the right to limit our exports. We intend to cut back on the foreign sale of natural resources, which our own citizens will need in the future. No longer will your pipelines be able to carry our non-renewable oil and natural gas south. You will have to find other sources while we husband resources that our children will need for heat and transportation in our vast land. We will be passing legislation designed to repatriate investments by Canadians in the United States. We ask you to work with us by withdrawing your investments in Canada. With the repatriation of investments on both sides of the border, we trust that disruptions will be limited as these investments are put to work at home. We do not want to be a colony of the new American empire. We will band together with like-minded nations to avoid your military adventures and to pursue a peaceful life on this planet. Your empire will fail, as all others have, in time. We don't want to be buried in your wreckage. Have a nice life. Here's one for the students at UNBC and CNC. The Minister of Advanced Education, Shirley Bond, is miffed at the fact that the Canadian Federation of Students, an organization in which you are members, is protesting the cuts by the provincial Liberals. The Liberals are reported to be reviewing how the Canadian Federation of Students and other campus action groups are getting their funding. It seems that the Liberals have the illiberal policy of silencing opposition by any means possible. If our beloved Minister of Advanced Indoctrination has her way, we will have funding cuts for the CFS, the Prince George Public Interest Research Group, and even our beloved CFUR Radio. How dare students join the chorus of protest at the devastation being caused by the so-called Liberals and their rich supporters? It is your role as students to memorize and regurgitate the stuff that is handed to you in classes. It is none of your business if the outside world, into which you will emerge from the academic cocoon, is being dismantled for the benefit of corporations and their toadies. If you study very hard, earning good grades in the appropriate field, you might be able to beg some sort of short-term contract from one of these rich corporations that will enable you to keep up with your student loan payments. But while you are memorizing your lessons, do not pay any attention to what these liberal creeps are doing to your society. It's none of your business if your forests are taken away, your tuition increased, your public transportation dismantled, your medical system privatized, and your future jobs eliminated. What the hell do you care? I think it is time for some strong expressions of support for anyone who opposes the damage that these creeps are doing to our society. Support the organizations that support you. In the spirit of Remembrance Day, in war, the first casualty is truth. The second casualty is economics. When a state perceives itself to be faced with a threat of extinction at the hands of an enemy, all the rules of economics are cast aside. When the United States faced the Nazis in World War II, President Roosevelt decided to develop the atomic bomb. There were no laws of supply and demand to be balanced out with mathematical precision. There was only the demand. Do it. Likewise, when the Nazis had their oil supplies cut by the Allies, there was no consideration of the costs and benefits of producing synthetic oil. The demand went out from Hitler. Do it. Although we allegedly have a peacetime economy, the shadow of war has loomed over us continuously ever since that Second World War. The military has the command economy, while the civilian population has the laws of economics. When the U.S. military wants nuclear weapons, advanced fighter aircraft, or the many needs that it perceives, the Congress writes a check. When the poor need housing, civilians need medical insurance, or the cities need schools, there is economics to deal with. No money in the budget. They cannot raise taxes. Business would flee to Mexico. You know the drill. Here in Prince George, we cannot find money to house all of our citizens. We are limited by the municipal budget, a provincial government which gave away all of its candy to the rich, and a federal government that is obsessed with maintaining a budget surplus. But if the provincial government wants to hold an Olympic party for business, there's $1 billion in the pot. If the military needs Britain's obsolete, leaky, cast-off submarines, the money is there. The Berlin Wall came down in 1989, and we were supposed to get a peace dividend from the end of the Cold War waste of preparing for hot war. Where's the dividend? Generals don't want to be shoe clerks. Military contractors don't want to manufacture kitchen gadgets. Preparation for war makes a lot of money for some people. They will not let that easy money go for a flimsy reason like a lack of enemies. Find an enemy, ordered the heads of states. Lo and behold, the war on drugs came along just in time. Solution? Bomb Panama. That involved into the threat of narco-terrorism. Solution? Attack Colombia. Both so-called wars were forerunners of the real main feature, the clash of civilizations. Solution, bomb Afghanistan. Attack Iraq. We are never without a need to maintain and equip a huge military machine. And by we, I mean Canadians as well as Americans. We are swept into their orbit and we cannot easily avoid it. We allowed them to test their cruise missiles here. We leased them Nanoose Bay to test their submarines. We send peacekeepers to clean up their messes. We don't have a massive military machine now, but we are under pressure to build one. Now comes the economics. Globalization was supposed to make us all rich. A rising tide lifts all boats. But those without boats drown in a rising tide. Half the people on this planet live on less than $2 Yankee a day. Living on under $2 a day is not my idea of peace. But what is peace? The easy answer is that it's the absence of war, but true peace is more than that. In my estimation, a peaceful society must meet a number of criteria. We cannot have peace without justice. I worked for 15 years in the provincial so-called correction system here in Prince George. I say so-called as there was no correcting involved. That's just another weasel euphemism we have learned to live with. We warehouse the poor, the demented, the nasty, and the ignorant. I learned one thing soon enough. There are two standards of justice at work, one for the rich and one for the poor. The poor are thrown into the system with scant protections, while the rich are seldom even investigated for their crimes, and when they are, they're handled with kid gloves. Until the justice system is made to hold the same standards for rich and poor, we'll have no peace in our society. Another element of true peace is a political system where people's needs and aspirations are addressed by their government. We cannot have that peace while elections go to the highest bidder. An element of peace is social cohesion, but that is eroded when some people have extreme wealth, living in gated communities with all their private services, while outside others go hungry and cold. An element of peace is equality of opportunity. We cannot have that when there is racism, sexism, and all of the other current isms preventing individuals from competing fairly with others. An element of peace is the democratic right to form together in groups to promote our mutual welfare. We find that right under assault by corporations and their provincial government allies at this moment. This government has declared war on unions and student movements. A peaceful society is one that is not suffocating in its own waste. I well know the waste of resources involved in maintaining a military force, as I was in ordnance supply. We may have no money to feed our disadvantaged, educate our children, or provide timely medical care to our citizens, but there's money to support non-productive members of the military. While on a recent trip to Victoria, my wife and I stood on Clover Point, where Victoria's untreated sewage is piped directly into the sea, because that wealthy city cannot afford to treat the waste. From that point, we watched the contrails of military planes playing useless games over our heads, wasting our oil and fouling our air. Plenty of money for that. Peace requires that we have mutual respect between ourselves and our politicians. We cannot respect them if they act with impunity against our welfare. They will not respect us if they have the means to keep us divided and scared. In Canada, this is accomplished with police goon squads and the military for backup. When I was a soldier, I used to wonder why so much of our training was in riot control when the Soviet Union was supposed to be the threatening enemy. It's quite clear to me now. We were there primarily to protect the government from the people. I think that if we want real social peace and a truly responsive government, we have to disarm the politicians. I do not believe they are to be trusted with the means to control us by force beyond ordinary policing forces. At the risk of arousing the ire of the Canadian Legion, I propose abolishing the Canadian Armed Forces. We have only one potential enemy, and against it we cannot defend ourselves. Better not to have a military than one which would just provide target practice for an invading enemy. Worse yet, to have a Canadian army that might be collaborators with these foreign troops, with whom they are now well integrated through training and command. Canada could put up a credible defense as the Swiss do, by having a well-trained militia, which would make an enemy pay dearly in blood for a victory and subsequent occupation. As for peacekeeping, let us donate to the United Nations and let them raise a truly international peacekeeping force. The armed forces for civil emergencies? You don't need military training and weapons to give humanitarian aid. We could have an emergency response system staffed by people well-trained to deal with forest fires, earthquakes, floods, and all the other goodies that life hands us. For search and rescue and asserting our sovereignty on our coasts and oceans, a good Coast Guard and Civil Air Patrol would beat fighter planes and submarines. We could support all of the above on less cost than we now allocate to military forces. We could use the resulting real peace dividend to finance steps toward real peace in our community, society, and world. Canada could lead the world, including our overarmed empire to the south, into an era of disarmament and peace through our example. Maybe then we could finally find that peace dividend that we have been searching for. On a related issue, it is pretty clear that the United States has declared a low-intensity war against Canada. I don't know what their purpose is for sure, but it seems to be directed at forcing us to change our immigration policies, increase military spending to prepare for our integration in their colonial forces, and generally take over a bit of our economy and resources that are left to us. A good number of bad people in British Columbia welcoming the coming status as outright colony of the United States. There will be money to be made by the Compradors and the Quislings. Real estate peddlers come to mind. They and their ignorant allies, largely adherents to the provincial Liberal Party, think it would be great to be able to use American dollars and to be able to go to Disneyland without crossing any borders. For these folks, I have a message. Every day there are buses, trains, and planes going across that border to the precious United States of America. Rush right down and buy a one-way ticket. If you want to be an American, go for it. I won't miss you, but don't plan on taking your country with you. This is Uncle Don concluding this session of Uncle Don Reads the Comics for the 13th of November, 2002. Barring assassination by overzealous American heroes, I will be back next Wednesday at 11:30 a.m. on CFUR Radio, 88.7 FM. Remember the wise words of Austin O'Malley, "God shows his contempt for wealth by the kind of person he selects to receive it." He may have been right, but it's still nicer to have money than the alternative.